Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Father Timothy Balama. I'm a member of the faculty here. And it is my great pleasure to present to you Professor Bruce Marshall for his remarkable contributions to the Thomistic circles. He is well known by many of us here, but some introduction will be necessary all the same. In 1985, Professor Marshall was awarded a PhD from Yale University, where he became good friends with our very own, and now, Archbishop Joseph Augustine de Noia. He also holds a Master of Arts in Religion degree from Yale Divinity School, 1979, and a BA from Northwestern University, 1977. Professor Marshall is the Layman Professor of Christian Doctrine at Southern Methodist University. His teaching responsibilities, or specialties, are medieval and Reformation theology and systematic theology. His research interests are the doctrine of the Trinity, Christology, philosophical issues in theology, sacramental theology, Judaism, and Christian theology. His publications are far too numerous for listing here. Still, we will mention a few. Trinity and Truth, a monograph published in Cambridge University Press, 2000. Another book, Christology in Conflict, The Identity of a Savior in Rahner and Barth, Blackwell, 1987. He was the editor of Theology and Dialogue, Essays in Conversation with George Lindbeck, University of Notre Dame Press, 1990. Also, the piece, The Dereliction of Christ and the Impassibility of God in Divine Impassibility and the Mystery of Human Suffering, edited by our very own Father Thomas Joseph White, Erdmans, 2009. I'll stop there. His professional distinctions include, but are by no means limited to the following. He's a member of the Academy of Catholic Theology, where he was president from 2008 to 2009, the National Endowment for the Humanities, he's a fellow, the Pew Evangelical Scholars, fellow, editorial boards of Nova et Vetera and Pro Ecclesia. The title of his presentation, Jesus's Human Knowledge, a Test for Theological Exegesis. Please join me in offering a warm welcome to Professor Bruce Marshall.
Thanks so much, Father Balama, for that very generous introduction. It's a great pleasure to be back in the House of Studies. I've been here many, many times over the years, and I always love being here and seeing old and meeting new friends. I'm guessing that Professor Witherington and I are about the same age, but he's much more technologically sophisticated than I am, so I don't have my lecture available for you in electronic form, alas. I'm going to do it the old-fashioned way and just talk to you and do my best to help you take it in. Benedict XVI begins his trilogy, Jesus of Nazareth, with what he calls a brief initial reflection on the mystery of Jesus. The key to understanding the figure of Jesus, Benedict proposes, lies not in the New Testament, but in the Old, in the prophecy of Moses in Deuteronomy 18:15. Moses there promises the Israelites that God will one day raise up a prophet like me from among you. Like Moses, this prophet will come to come will be one whom the Lord knows face to face as one friend knows another. Yet the friendship with God of this future prophet will be even greater than that of Moses, who after all saw only God's back, even though he spoke with God in the obscurity of the cloud that covered Mount Sinai with the intimacy of a friend. To this new Moses, this last prophet, quoting Benedict, will be granted what was refused to the first one, a real immediate vision of the face of God, and thus the ability to speak entirely from seeing, end quote, not just from hearing or from looking only at God's back. Jesus' teaching, but also his action and suffering, have their ultimate source for Benedict in, quote, this immediate contact with the Father, this vision of the one who rests close to the Father's heart. End quote. A vision in which Jesus' human consciousness and his will, his human soul, fully participate. Harnack's dictum that Jesus teaches only of the Father and makes no claims about himself is therefore, in Benedict's eyes, self-refuting. What Jesus teaches about the Father would be presumptuous, indeed blasphemous, unless it came from a unique, indeed unsurpassable, intimacy with the Father, a face-to-face vision. As Benedict goes on to say, Jesus approaches his baptism already possessing a full awareness of his identity and mission. His grasp of who he is stems from that human vision of the face of the Father, which makes him the promised prophet greater than Moses. Jesus thus enters the depths of the Jordan, knowing that he is the unsurpassable prophet, the final mediator between God and humanity. In those depths, he deliberately begins our redemption, the binding of the strong man that will culminate in his passion, death, resurrection, and glorification. Benedict links all this to a high estimate of the historical value of the fourth gospel, and in particular, the words Jesus speaks according to John. Pope Benedict thus seems to embrace the traditional theological claim that Jesus already enjoyed the immediate vision of God in his human soul in his earthly life, prior to his resurrection, prior to his baptism, indeed. His acceptance, Benedict's acceptance of this claim, seems in fact to be quite deliberate, inasmuch as it serves as the initial key for everything that he will go on to say about Jesus in all three volumes of his trilogy. All of the words, deeds, and sufferings of the Lord spring from his unsurpassable human vision of God. The Pope speaks in biblical terms and does not touch on the scholastic concepts in which the claim was traditionally made, that Jesus, well before his resurrection and glorification, has that human vision of God than which a greater cannot be conceived. But it is not much of a stretch to read the opening chapter of Jesus of Nazareth as an endorsement of the view that Jesus has the beatific vision throughout his earthly life. Now, Jesus said a man's enemies will be those of his own house, and Benedict was to discover that the truth of that prophecy extends even to the papal household. Shortly after the Pope's book was published in 2007, Father Ennio Cantalamessa, a longtime preacher to the papal household, still, I believe, preacher to the papal household, I may be behind the times, gave a public lecture in Rome in which he questioned the cogency of Benedict's whole approach to the mystery of Jesus. While expressing great appreciation for the Pope's book as an expression of the Church's faith in Jesus, Father Cantalamessa voiced the following, what he called, small reservation. Quote, "I think that the continuity between the Jesus of history and the Christ of the kerygma and of dogma, for all that it is real, is not quite as rectilinear as is made to appear in the summary introduction to the book," the passages I just quoted. We must accept, Father Cantalamessa argued, that, quote, "Christians after Easter said greater and more important things about Jesus than the historical Jesus would have said about himself," end quote. Most exegetes and theologians have agreed with Father Cantalamessa's criticism of a rectilinear continuity in Pope Benedict's book between Jesus in his earthly life and Jesus in his risen life. Few have been quite as gentle about it as the papal preacher was, especially when he attributes to Jesus a unique face-to-face vision of God even prior to his public mission. Most interpreters or readers of Benedict's book, at least if they were biblical scholars and theologians, have found Benedict's interpretation of the mystery of Jesus exegetically and theologically unnecessary, at best, if not wholly implausible on historical and theological grounds. In the past 50 years or so, there have, in fact, been very few Catholic exegetes who would see the claim that Jesus had the immediate vision of God in his earthly life as historically plausible or exegetically warranted, to say nothing of Protestant biblical scholars, who, when they address the question, are more likely to put it in terms of whether Jesus knew he was God before, or perhaps indeed after, his resurrection. Systematic or dogmatic theologians in the Catholic orbit have largely followed the suit of their exegetical colleagues. Thus, in his later writings, Karl Rahner, with, as usual, various reservations, qualifications, and hypothetical hesitations, doubts that Jesus had the beatific vision during the course of his earthly life. With, as usual, no reservations, qualifications, or hypothetical hesitations, Hans-Urs von Balthasar likewise doubts it. Many others, at least one of whom is in this room, think in similar terms and have written extensively along this line. The argument goes that it's all right to believe that Jesus had the beatific vision from the moment of his resurrection, and indeed that he then came to know the truth of everything the Nicene Creed says about him. But for various historical, metaphysical, and soteriological reasons, which I will discuss in a minute, it is not all right in this view to attribute any of this to Jesus up to the point of the Triduum Mortis, up to the point of the tomb. So what I'd like to do here is first outline, briefly at least, against their historical background, some of the main theological arguments that long made Jesus' enjoyment of the beatific vision throughout his earthly life seem undeniable in Catholic theology, including the basic exegetical appeals that have funded this traditional view. Then I'll consider several objections against the traditional view and offer some suggestions as to how those objections might be met. I'll conclude with some brief, very brief, reflections on why the traditional view, no matter how strong or vigorous the theological and exegetical support that's offered for it, has such a hard time gaining a hearing, let alone agreement, in contemporary exegesis and theology, not least Catholic exegesis and theology. Theological reflection on the nature and limits of Christ's human knowledge developed rather slowly in the Christian tradition. New Testament texts suggesting ignorance in Christ, for example, Mark 13:32, no one knows the day or the hour, not the angels in heaven, nor even the Son, but only the Father. Texts like this were used by Arian or quasi-Arian writers in the 4th century to argue against the full divinity of Christ. So defenders of Nicaea, defenders of the Nicene position in the 4th and early 5th century, routinely assigned these ignorance passages, these nescience passages in the New Testament, which attribute ignorance to Jesus, assign them to his humanity, the humanity of the incarnate word, and deny that they have any application to him in virtue of his divinity. Attributing to Jesus' humanity his apparent ignorance of important matters, like when the last judgment is going to happen, was an obvious recourse in these fourth century debates, when the crucial point was to shield the divinity of Christ from any attributions that would diminish its perfection, and so the full equality of the Son with the Father. But further reflection began to suggest that this move, while right and good as far as it goes, creates a large problem of its own, several problems, and that biblical texts about what Jesus doesn't know will have to be handled in some other way than by simply conceding ignorance to him when it comes to his humanity and blocking it from his divinity. To put it slightly bluntly, fobbing ignorance off on Jesus' human nature will come to seem as damaging Christologically as finding it in his divine nature was already seen to be damaging theologically, that is, in the doctrine of the Trinity. The first Christian writer to reflect in a more than passing way on Jesus' human knowledge and its extent was evidently St. Fulgentius of Ruspe, North African bishop writing around the year 520. His letter 14 is a long treatise in answer to a series of questions posed by his student and associate Ferrandus of Carthage. One of these questions, to which Fulgentius devotes a considerable amount of attention, is whether Jesus knew his own divinity, and if so, how his human knowledge of the Trinity differs from the knowledge of the Trinity that belongs to the person of the Word as such. Fulgentius writes, of course, in the wake of the still controversial Christological decisions of Ephesus and Chalcedon. He's clearly aware of the teaching of those councils, and he makes a deliberate effort to bring the content and logic of these conciliar decisions to bear on the specific question about Jesus' human knowledge that Ferrandus poses to him. The 17th century theologian Louis de Thomassin credits Fulgentius with having beautifully articulated, even at this early point in Christian history, the essential elements of a proper teaching on Christ's human knowledge. Thomasin, or Ludovicus Thomasinus, as he published in Latin, was a staggeringly learned student of the Church Fathers, and he was among the first to apply the explosion of patristic scholarship in the 17th century to standard theological topics in a thoroughgoing way, especially in Christology and Trinitarian theology. In his elaborate discussion of the fullness of divine and blessed knowledge in the soul of Christ, as he calls it, Plenitudo Scientiae Divinae et Beatae in Anima Christi, as Thomasin heads a very long section of his major dogmatic work, he takes his cues from St. Fulgentius, writing almost 1,200 years later. I won't go into St. Fulgentius' multifaceted argument here for the sake of time, save to observe that Fulgentius' main way of supporting the claim that Jesus has the full and immediate human knowledge of God in his earthly life is pneumatological, based on John 3:34, he does not give the Spirit without measure, rather than more directly Christological, as it would be later on. But about the basic claim involved, Fulgentius is very clear, quote, "It is thoroughly foreign to a healthy faith to say that the soul of Christ does not have a full knowledge of his own deity." It's only with the rise of scholasticism, however, that Jesus' human knowledge becomes a standard theological topic, and sustained reflection about its nature and extent becomes routine within the Chalcedonian tradition in the West. Scholastic theology developed to the point where it normally attributed several different kinds of human knowledge to Jesus, including an acquired or experimental knowledge like that of other viatores, other wayfarers, such as you and I, but also a blessed or immediate vision, which only he among wayfarers can possess. As far as I can tell, there's general agreement in the Christian theological tradition that Jesus possesses at least these two quite distinct types of human knowledge, an acquired knowledge and an immediate vision, from the Middle Ages up until the Enlightenment. And usually there's a third type, midway between the other two, namely an infused knowledge, which is also attributed to Jesus and about which I gather that we'll hear more from Simon Gain tomorrow. This seems not to have been questioned. I'm focusing particularly on Jesus having an immediate vision of God. This seems not to have been questioned, certainly not in a thematic way, by the Protestant Reformation or Protestant scholasticism. Since it was the subject of neither inter- nor extramural dispute, the Catholic Magisterium offers very little teaching on it until the early 20th century. With the Enlightenment, Protestant theology had begun to deny that Jesus had anything like the immediate vision of God in his earthly life, beginning in the late 18th century. This was usually in connection with a rejection or a radical reconceiving of the traditional doctrine of the Incarnation. Not that all Protestant theologians followed this path, to be sure. Within the general framework of the traditional teaching that Jesus did have the immediate vision of God throughout his earthly life, there was extensive discussion of Jesus' human knowledge in Catholic theology from the 19th century up to Vatican II, often in uneasy dialogue with the modern notion that self-consciousness is constitutive of personal identity. Some of the contributors to this Catholic theological debate in the 19th and 20th centuries, Hermann Schell, for instance, already give voice, in the late 19th century in Schell's case, to multiple objections against what he calls the older view, which attributes this threefold human knowledge to Christ, although Schell does not clearly embrace the denial of an immediate vision, he just raises a lot of questions about it. Since Vatican II or thereabouts, however, Catholic theologians and exegetes have regularly maintained that Jesus simply lacked this immediate knowledge, this beatifying knowledge, until the resurrection at the earliest. So let's look at Aquinas, who is a particularly influential advocate of the traditional view in its scholastic form, and think a bit about the kinds of arguments he makes to support this claim. Aquinas thinks Jesus' possession of the beatific vision follows clearly from the most basic principles of the Church's faith in the Incarnation. More precisely, the incarnation of the Logos requires that the human being who is God incarnate receive the supreme grace possible for a human creature. This human being is, as Scripture teaches, the Father's only Son, full of grace. Equally, saving grace in us, the second basic point for Aquinas, saving grace in us must always be a sharing in the unique and intrinsic plenitude of grace that dwells in the human soul of Christ. From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. Our grace in us, our knowledge of God, is a participation in Jesus' knowledge of God, whether an umbilical connection, as Ben Witherington warned us to be careful about, or not, is another question, but certainly a sharing in his, and not something we have on our own, apart from that umbilical connection. Basic to Jesus' fullness of grace, Aquinas holds, is not only the greatest possible love of God, but the greatest possible knowledge of God, face-to-face vision. In fact, the former, the love of God in Jesus' human soul, is dependent on the fullness of knowledge in his soul, since on the whole, love depends upon knowledge. We cannot love what we don't know. The main argument Aquinas gives for the common view, that's the common in his world and both before and after, that the human soul of Jesus enjoys the immediate vision of God is soteriological. He reasons along the following lines. The final goal of all human life, is the immediate vision of God. That being the case, every human being is, as such, simply in virtue of being human, capable of receiving this vision. Each of us exists in the Aristotelian terms that Thomas employs with the potency or the potentiality for the beatific vision. That's part of what it means to say that we're created in the image of God. Scripture teaches, furthermore, that any of us who actually attains the vision for which we were made receives it from the human being Jesus, or from Jesus in his humanity. Aquinas here refers to Hebrews 2:10, the one through whom and for whom all things exist. That one has led many sons and daughters to glory. Since Jesus causes the beatific vision in any other human being who comes to have it, he must possess that vision in the best possible way. And this means that he himself can never have been in potency to the vision of God, but must always have enjoyed it fully. As the human being who alone can give the beatific vision to others who can reduce their potency to act, this vision must belong to him intrinsically as an inherent feature of his unique personal identity and constitution. To this, Aquinas adds an important corollary. Our own enjoyment of the immediate vision of God when it comes is entirely a participation in Jesus' own visio. In this respect, the beatific vision in us is like everything else that comes to us by grace. It does not simply run parallel to Jesus' apprehension of the face of the Father, qualitatively similar to his, but discrete from it, so he's simply the first in a series. Rather, our vision remains forever dependent on his, not only like it, but actively caused by it. That is, a participation in it, resemblance coupled with causal dependence. This is part of what it means to say that Jesus is the head of the church. The same thing goes, namely the knowledge we have as a participation in Jesus' vision of God, the same thing goes for the dim apprehension of God that we have by faith in this life. It too is a participation, although an inadequate and perfectible participation in Jesus' own immediate knowledge of the Father. Aquinas elsewhere offers a more directly Christological argument to this same conclusion, Jesus' possession of the immediate vision of God, inherently, just given the human being that he is, though I think for him the Christological argument is secondary to the soteriological one. But here's the argument. The human soul of Christ is as close to God as it is possible for any creature to be, since it, his soul, or more precisely, the individuated human nature of which his soul is an integral part, is hypostatically united to a divine person. It's not possible to get any closer to God if you're a creature. The blessed in heaven are united to God in a less intense way, that is, by grace rather than by hypostatic union. Yet the Beati enjoy the immediate vision of God and by it reach the term of their human existence. So, Aquinas argues, a fortiori, the human soul of Jesus must have the immediate vision of God as long as it is personally united to the Word, which is to say, now and forever. Thus, the strong statements that Thomas makes, such as the following from the Compendium Theologiae. The soul of Christ, having the highest perfection of the vision of God among all other creatures, fully sees in God himself all the works of God and the reasons for them, whatever those works are, will be, or have been. Thus, still Aquinas, thus his soul illumines not only human beings, but even the highest of the angels. As Scripture teaches, still quoting Aquinas, in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and of the knowledge of God. End quote. Now suppose that Jesus didn't have this immediate vision of God that Aquinas has so robustly attributed to him. Suppose that he did not possess the direct vision of God intrinsically, and whatever that vision entails, such as full clarity about his own mission and his identity as Son of God. Suppose instead that Jesus received this at some point in his life, such as his resurrection, after having previously not enjoyed it. Suppose that he was in potency, to use Thomas's terms, to the beatific vision and received it at some point in his own history. In that case, Jesus, like the rest of us, would have lived first of all without the beatific vision and then received it in potency for the immediate apprehension of God, and so would have needed to receive it from someone else who did possess it intrinsically. Perhaps he received it from the Logos, conceived now as an individual person other than himself. Or perhaps he received it from the persons of the Trinity conjointly, of whom he was not himself one. In any case, it would not then be correct to say that the human being Jesus gives or could give the vision of God to us. He could not be the source or cause of that blessedness in which the fullness, the fulfillment of our life's final purpose consists, nor could our possession of it be a participation in his. Rather, he, like the rest of us, would receive it from some source or cause personally distinct from himself, in whose possession, that causes possession of the vision, he would, like us, also share. And this is simply to say that Jesus is not himself the universal Savior, but one among the saved, perhaps the first. Perhaps he's the first to enjoy the vision of God, and we all enjoy it after him. As such, Jesus could at most be the occasion or channel of our salvation at the hands of another for whom we would then need to look. So rather than being a dispensable piece of scholastic arcana, Jesus' immediate vision of God throughout the whole course of his human existence seems rooted in fundamental soteriological and Christological principles. As I mentioned at the outset, this conclusion is widely rejected in contemporary theology. Two main objections are typically lodged against it. First of all, it's objected that this is incompatible with the full humanity of Jesus Christ. To attribute the immediate vision of God to him in his pre-resurrection life is at best an implicit monophysitism. Whatever we might want to say about the vision of God in a state beyond this life, so the objection goes, no human being in our space and time, and even more in our world of sin and death, can see God face to face. If we attribute this to Jesus, we are effectively taking him out of our space and time, the world of our sin and death. But why should this be the case? If the Son of God assumes our human nature, it must be possible, at least, for that assumed nature to exist in any state or condition of which this nature is inherently capable. On this principle, that the assumed nature of God, the Word, could exist in any condition compatible with having such a nature, there are presumably two limits. Any state or condition of the human nature of the incarnate word must be compatible, first of all, with a personal union of that nature with the word, and second of all, with a saving with the saving mission on account of which the word assumes our human nature in the first place. If human nature is inherently capable of the direct vision of God, then it would seem that it's possible for the humanity of the word incarnate to exist in that condition. If our nature is held not to be capable of this, then of course there's nothing left to talk about in Jesus' case or any other. If the humanity of Jesus in fact exists in this condition, Fulgentius and Aquinas, among others, argue, is not only compatible with his existence as the incarnate word and with his saving mission, but is required by both. The second objection is that Jesus' possession of the vision of God in his pre-Easter life is incompatible with the reality of his human suffering. This is really a specification of the first objection, and especially with the agony and dereliction of the cross. No one who saw God face to face could suffer, so the objection goes, as the Gospels clearly attest that Jesus did. To attribute the immediate vision of God to the unrisen Jesus, especially on the cross, undercuts his solidarity with us, so the objection goes, at just the point where it is most needed, his subjection to our experience of hopeless suffering and divine abandonment. In just this way, so the objection argues, attributing the immediate vision of God to Jesus in his earthly life undercuts, traduces his saving mission. Now, unlike the first objection, the traditional view thought this second one was serious and gave it a considerable amount of thought. Aquinas' own solution, to abbreviate somewhat, is basically to say there's no contradiction or incoherence in saying that Jesus' whole human soul suffers in one respect, indeed suffers most greatly in one respect, and at the same time does not suffer in another respect. So it's not incoherent, Aquinas argues, to say that Jesus at one and the same time undergoes the greatest of all suffering, is there any suffering like my suffering, from Lamentations 1, while at the same time enjoying the immediate vision of God. Here, for Aquinas, the distinction between the essence and the powers of the soul is basic. Thomas deploys it to argue that even on the cross, the highest power of Jesus' human soul continues to see God directly. And this is the cause, quoting Aquinas now, not of sadness, but of delight and joy. While at the same time, all the lower powers of the soul, those which mediate the deliverances of the senses, cause the greatest suffering. But it is not, in Aquinas' view, as though Jesus' soul is sliced in two, and the upper half does not know what the lower half is going through. That's not the picture. The whole soul is equally the subject of all of its powers. So the whole soul suffers most greatly, and the whole soul rejoices with inexpressible joy. We might, and Thomas himself notes this, suppose that it's impossible simultaneously to suffer and rejoice, indeed to suffer most greatly and to rejoice most greatly. But there's no contradiction here, Thomas argues, for the simple reason that while the same soul wholly suffers and wholly rejoices, it does so in irreducibly different ways, in irreducibly different respects. And nothing, as even basic logic should tell us, nothing prevents contraries from being true of the same particular as long as they're not held to be true in the same respect, as long as they're true of it in different ways. Despite Thomas's logical rejoinder, his appeal to what is and isn't a contradiction, this all may seem psychologically implausible to us, indeed, maybe even absurd. But I don't think it's difficult to find everyday analogs for the sort of thing that Aquinas is talking about. Think of a person like the physicist Stephen Hawking, who suffers some enormous bodily liabilities, yet evidently finds great joy in the adventure of pure thought, joy that shows through his liabilities when one sees him speaking or communicating, might be a better way to put it. Or think of many Christian martyrs, including many in our own time, who have undergone the cruelest sorts of tortures, often preceded by long periods in which to anticipate the agony to come. Yet they lived and died in serenity and joy out of love for Christ. One would want to, I presume, not to say that their serenity somehow inoculated them or anesthetized them against their suffering, now that they genuinely suffered, but yet were able to suffer with joy and serenity. They had not yet obtained the beatific vision, but still were able to combine extreme suffering with interior joy. So evidently this is psychologically possible, even if many of us find it hard to imagine ourselves in that position. So all the more, it should be possible for Jesus to unite that suffering like no other with a face-to-face vision of God. Part of our difficulty in following Thomas and others at this point may stem from the assumption that we know in advance what it would look like for a human being in our space and time to have the vision of God, the immediate vision of God. And we may presume that such a human being would not look like a crucified and abandoned innocent. But surely we cannot tell with any clarity from our present condition, marred as it is epistemically and otherwise by sin and its consequences, what such a person would look like or such an experience would be like. We have to learn that, so far as we presently can, from the incarnate Word himself. This is, in part, I think, the point of Thomas's claim that from Mary's womb to the cross, Jesus is both viator, pilgrim, wayfarer, and comprehensor, one who sees God. He is both one who suffers and one who sees God from the beginning of his earthly life to the end. This is true, of course, of him alone, and if we go off the rails if we suppose that our own knowledge and experience can decide for us that he must be one or the other, but cannot be both. In fact, I think the strongest objection to Aquinas' reasoning on this matter, at least at one crucial point, is not modern or contemporary, but medieval. Duns Scotus argues in his commentaries on Distinction 2 of Book 3 of the Sentences that God need not give the immediate vision of his essence even to his own human soul, that is, to the human nature united hypostatically to him in the person of the Son. There's no contradiction, Scotus argues, in a divine person uniting a created nature to himself, even a rational nature, yet not conferring on that nature its ultimate fruition, namely beatitude by way of vision. The vision of his essence, Scotus argues, this is the crucial underlying conviction. The vision of his essence can only be freely conferred by God upon any creature, including his own human soul. Along with every other relation of God to creatures, the immediate vision of his essence is always and ultimately contingent on God's own will to bestow it. Here, as in many other places, Scotus finds in the views of his predecessors, including St. Thomas, implausible and spurious claims to necessity. Claims that there's necessity where there really isn't. And these claims need to be uprooted if we are to truly appreciate the magnitude and the depth of God's generosity. In Scotus's view, not in Aquinas's, but in Scotus's view, God could have undertaken the impoverished incarnation without the immediate vision of God that is the stock in trade of contemporary Catholic theology. But this impoverished incarnation, while it was possible for God, would have been profoundly less generous than what God has actually done, and would probably have left the incarnation without any adequate motive. Grasping that even an incarnate God didn't have to do this for us only increases our awareness of his generosity in actually doing it. So Scotus finds the metaphysically oriented Christological arguments for Christ's possession of the beatific vision unconvincing, as they're propounded by Aquinas and Henry of Ghent, who is his direct target. However, with what I've called Thomas's soteriological argument to the same conclusion, that Christ has the beatific vision throughout his earthly life, Scotus strongly agrees. Both assume, that is, both Scotus and Aquinas, assume that God has in fact decided to confer the beatific vision upon human beings, not one by one, starting from scratch in each case, but rather that God has decided to do this in such a way that all who have this vision receive it as a participation in the possession and enjoyment of it by someone else. That is, all who have it receive it by participation except the single human being who shares his possession of it with the rest of us. That, of course, is Christ. That one, Scotus agrees with Aquinas, cannot have received this vision from another, but must simply possess it. It must just go with being who he is. He especially cannot have received it at some point past the beginning of his own personal history, such as the resurrection. Instead, the immediate vision of God just goes with being this particular human being, as in general, what is participated must possess any qualities in which others participate intrinsically and not himself or itself by participation in something else. In Thomas's terms, what we have here is a case not of absolute or unqualified necessity, necessity simpliciter, but of necessity given an assumption, necessity ex suppositione. The assumption is that God has decided to give us beatitude by participation in Jesus' own human vision of himself. And given that assumption, Scotus and Aquinas agree on the soteriological argument. Okay, what then about the texts that ascribe ignorance to Jesus in the New Testament? How do we interpret these? The one that particularly worried the traditional position, and again, I'll have Aquinas as my interlocutor here, the one that particularly worried the tradition was Matthew 24:36, where Jesus, speaking of the Last Judgment, says, "No one knows the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, but the Father alone." And as Thomas notes, the parallel in Mark 13, verse 32, intensifies the difficulty, since Mark makes explicit what Matthew leaves implicit, or as we might say today, what Matthew leaves out. Even a 13th century writer was capable of observing that there are differences between the Gospels, and sometimes they're really important, because what Matthew doesn't say, but Mark does say, is no one knows the day or the hour, not the angels in heaven, but only the Father. No one knows the day or the hour, not the angels, nor even the Son, but only the Father. So how do we handle this if we believe that Jesus has the immediate vision of God? I mean, this seems like a really important thing to know that Jesus doesn't know. And so since if you see the divine essence, you know everything that it's possible for you to know, there's a difficulty here. One way to handle it, Thomas observes, would be to attribute this ignorance, the ignorance of which the text plainly speaks, to the incarnate Son. To attribute it to the Son, but to ascribe it to him qua human being, or secundum quod homo in Aquinas' language, ascribe it to him as Son of Man, but not as God the Son. As I mentioned, this was a common recourse in the anti-Arian exegesis and theology of late antiquity, but Thomas argues that it won't work. The human soul of Christ, as the evangelist testifies, is full of grace and truth. Christ's human soul can't be full of truth if there are truths he doesn't know. If that were the case, if there were truths that Jesus doesn't know in his human soul, the evangelist wouldn't have said, "We have beheld his glory full of grace and truth." He would have said, "We have beheld some glory with quite a bit of grace and a good deal of truth." So Aquinas here, of course, is insisting that we interpret the troublesome, difficult text. It's quite clear that it's difficult given his position in Mark 24 and Matthew 13 in light of John 1. Besides, Thomas goes on to argue against this idea that we can attribute the ignorance to Jesus in his human soul and not in his divinity. It borders on the absurd to suppose that the Father has given Jesus, as St. Thomas and everyone else in his age was clear that he had, that the Father has given Jesus, the human being Jesus, the power of judgment over all things, and yet willfully held back from him the knowledge or even the capacity to know the time of his own advent to judge the living and the dead. This seems odd, to say the least. Incongruous, inconvenient, as St. Thomas puts it literally. So how should we interpret this troublesome text? Following an exegetical tradition that goes back to the Church Fathers, Aquinas argues that we shouldn't, despite appearances, read the text as though it attributed ignorance of the last day to the incarnate Son. No one knows the day or the hour, not even the Son. Whether as Son of God or as Son of Man, we shouldn't attribute it to him. In fact, this gospel text, as Aquinas reads it, and again, this is not original with him, attributes ignorance and even more the absence of the immediate vision of God, not to Jesus, but to us, not to the head, but to the members. Well, how do you work that out? It seems flatly contradictory to the plain sense of the text. Not really, says St. Thomas, employing once again arguments that aren't original with him. He grants, I think, that it goes against the surface grammar of the text. But reading it his way, he argues, actually allows the text to exhibit what he calls a modus loquendi, a pattern of speech that's familiar to us, and importantly so, from other passages of Scripture. Consider, he observes, Genesis 22, the sacrifice of Isaac. Abraham there, having exhibited his fearful willingness to offer up his only son, hears God say to him, "Now I know that you fear God." On the surface, this seems to say that God has acquired an item of knowledge that he didn't previously possess, that Abraham fears him. But this can't be right. Aquinas argues, God knows all things, including Abraham's fear of him, before Abraham openly exhibits it on Mount Moriah. So the text should not be read to say that Abraham has made something known to God, but rather that God has made something known to Abraham and to Israel through all generations because of Abraham, by way of the foreknown action that Abraham would undertake. What he's made known, of course, to others, not to himself, is that Abraham fears him and that this is an important thing to know. So we have a pattern here. A scriptural agent, in this case God, is said to know something or come to know it, when what the text actually means is that he makes what he knows known to others. So to get the right reading of Mark 13 and Matthew 24, Aquinas argues, we simply run the interpretive pattern, the modus loquendi, in the opposite direction. On the surface, these texts attribute ignorance to the incarnate Son. But the texts are better read to say that the incarnate Son knows the day of judgment in his human soul, like the Father does, but in conformity to the will of the Father, has not made the last day known to us and will make it known to us only by bringing it about, as he made known Abraham's fear by bringing about the events on Mount Moriah. Scotus, I think, takes basically the same position, although I won't explore that now. Now, to modern wissenschaftlich exegesis of the New Testament, reading the Markan text this way seems wholly artificial. I see a New Testament head or two nodding. Indeed, if it's not artificial, it would be a soft way to put it. It's ludicrous, and indeed willfully and deliberately ludicrous. It's obviously wrong. So obvious that we don't even need to discuss why it's wrong. As obvious, indeed, as a lot of traditional exegesis and theology thought it must obviously be right. So I want to conclude quickly with just one or two comments about, or suggestions about, why current biblical interpretation and theology find it practically impossible even to entertain the thought that Scripture permits, still less teaches, that Jesus enjoyed the immediate vision of God throughout his earthly life. I mean, there are two assumptions that are particularly important here that make an exegesis like the one I just gave you from St. Thomas seem so preposterous to contemporary exegesis. One concerns assumptions about what responsible biblical interpretation involves, and the other concerns basic religious motivations. So regarding the notion of responsible biblical interpretation, we can't possibly construe these texts this way, so the argument might go, because we cannot ascribe any such thing as an immediate vision of God to Jesus in his earthly pre-resurrection life, since, and this is the crucial point, since this would be to admit that Jesus in his earthly life, the historical Jesus, as Jesus in his earthly life is sometimes misleadingly called, that this Jesus is, at this very significant point, inaccessible to historical knowledge. On the assumption that, like the resurrection itself, having the immediate vision of God is simply not the sort of thing we can have ordinary, rational, historical grounds to assert the existence of. Here, something like Trelch's principle of analogy and historical knowledge comes to the fore. We can only assert to have happened in history what we can construct some kind of comparison to our own experience, what we can construct with some kind of comparison to our own experience. We can't do that with the immediate vision of God, since we can't really imagine what it would be like to have that and walk and talk and chew gum. And so we can't rationally ascribe this to Jesus. Now, Catholic exegesis, there's and some Protestant exegesis too, for example, Protestant theology, that of the Wolfhard Pannenberg of the Grundzüge der Christologie, the argument goes like this: okay, when the resurrection happens, then we can say everything about Jesus that we couldn't say before. Now, the resurrection is an article of faith, okay? Not for Pannenberg, that's why he's not a good case here. The resurrection's an article of faith, so what we need to do is make a clear distinction between what belongs to historical knowledge, where Jesus can't have possessed the beatific vision, and what belongs to faith, the resurrection and everything that goes with it, including things like the beatific vision, and we keep these in discrete compartments. There's a kind of settlement, okay, that we can say the creed without embarrassment because everything that the creed says about Jesus is true once he's risen from the dead. Second concern, I think, is really, properly speaking, religious and has been, involves a kind of mode of piety or orientation toward God and Christ, and has been elaborated considerably in recent theology. And this is the idea that if we were to say that Jesus had the immediate vision of God in his earthly life, this would fatally undercut his solidarity with us, his identification or identifying with us in our misery and lostness. It would violate the rules of the soteriology and the theodicy of solidarity that are now widely taken for granted as necessary for meaningful Christian faith. We have to suppose that Jesus has really shared our lot and that he shared it all the way down. And if we say he has the vision of God while we don't, then he hasn't shared our lot. He hasn't really identified with us. Now, the traditional view from Augustine and Cyril of Alexandria, whom I haven't talked about, and to Fulgentius and the medieval doctors, Aquinas and Scotus and many others, the traditional view certainly thought that Christ's saving mission involves a profound solidarity with us. But in their understanding of the matter, there also has to be a definite limit to this solidarity in order for it to be a genuinely saving identification with us and not simply a being lost with us. Jesus has to differ from us in his humanity and not just in his divinity in order to save us. Where the limits of saving solidarity lie, indeed whether there are any genuine limits or whether we simply want as much solidarity as we can possibly imagine, that to me is a question that's at the heart of what looks like a deep conflict between the patristic and medieval exegesis and theology about Jesus' human knowledge and contemporary exegesis and theology on the same subject. Thanks very much for your late Friday attention.